What happens if a boat sinks, creates a hazard, and the owner can't be found? The state or local community could be on the hook to pay the cost of cleanup and salvage. That cost can run into millions of dollars. Why is cleaning up derelict vessels so expensive, and why is it difficult to track down the owners of them? We're looking at these questions and the big problem of pollution and waterway hazards that result from abandoned vessels today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast, and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
What can a tiny piece of dust do to you? It can stop you in your tracks. Studies show exposure to dust pollution can cause tightness in your chest, wheezing, and shortness of breath, even if you're healthy. When you're on an unpaved road, drive slowly, especially when operating an ATV. When hauling dirt, cover it up. Do your part, avoid dust, and clear the air. We'll all breathe easier. This message sponsored by Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing how to deal with vessels that have been left in a harbor or run up on the beach or rocks and abandoned. Before we get to my guests who are going to help us understand this issue, the subject of derelict vessels came up this morning at a U.S. Senate hearing on marine debris. Alaska's junior senator Dan Sullivan asked Deputy U.S. Fish and Wildlife Director Jim Kurth if he had any solutions.
I wish I did have an answer, Senator. When I worked in Alaska, we had a derelict vessel offshore of the Arctic Refuge where I worked, and it had been there for decades, and no one quite really knew what to do about that. And I think it's something that we're going to, you know, all have to come together and find out. When there's not a responsible party, you know, how do we work together with the affected states and with, you know, government agencies that have authority, because it's a problem that doesn't have a ready answer, at least to my knowledge.
So, you know, there's always the issue of, well, we can just fund cleanup on that. And of course, that's one way to look at it.
That was Senator Sullivan answering Deputy U.S. Fish and Wildlife Director Jim Kurth on the issue of derelict vessels. As Senator Sullivan went on to say that budgets are tight, and he inquired about using volunteer labor. Kurth said volunteers are a force multiplier, but Kurth also said the agency has lost out because, in some cases, it can't afford to use staff to coordinate the volunteers. So this problem is expensive. It's tough to find state and federal dollars in this climate of austerity. My guests in the studio are Justy McDonald and Steve Russell. Justy is the permitting unit manager for the Department of Natural Resources in the South Central area. Is that right, Justy?
Yes, South Central region.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Steve is the interagency coordination section manager for spill prevention and response for the state's Department of Environmental Conservation. Wow, Steve, we almost need to joke about sinking under the weight of your own title here.
It's a pretty lofty title, yes.
Well, thanks for being here, both of you. And on the phone is Rachel Lord. Rachel is the Clean Water Program Director for Cook Inlet Keeper. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Lori.
All right, and you can join our conversation if you or your community has had to deal with derelict vessels or had to change navigation because of a derelict hazard in a waterway. What do you think the state should do to get tough with owners of these decrepit boats? You can call us at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255, or if you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, a guy or a gal walks into a bar, scribbles some details on a napkin, and over a beer becomes the new owner of a boat. Sounds like the start of a bad joke, but it's actually just that easy for a vessel to transfer hands, and that's one of the reasons that it can be impossible to track down vessel owners. Finding the owners of boats that are old or in bad shape and at risk of sinking or have already gone to the bottom is a big headache. So I put that tease out there about ownership to keep our listeners on the edge of their seats. But let's start with some context. Steve, how big is the problem of abandoned or neglected vessels that are at risk of sinking?
There's several aspects of the derelict vessel task force focus that we're looking at, and really it starts with three distinct types of vessels. We have vessels of concern, which are vessels that are operating in many of our ports and harbors and river systems that are marginal as far as operations or financing or safety. They're a big problem in our harbors, and the harbor masters and port administrators are very concerned about those. But usually there's an owner involved, or there's a crew, and they're just essentially nuisance vessels that everyone who lives in a port community knows about. And then there's the derelict vessels, which, as you say, may not have an owner. They still may be floating, but they are in complete disrepair. They're taking up dock space or possibly anchored up somewhere in state lands or state waters or federal lands. And then there's the abandoned boats that are in a lot of cases stripped of anything that's of value. In most cases, there's no fuel or lubrication or anything, that's all been removed. And somebody has taken the vessel and pushed it up onto state submerged tide lands or corporation land or municipal land, and they've just abandoned and left it there. And we see the problem from Prudhoe Bay to Southeast. It's all along the coastlines and inside our river systems as well. So,
how, and Jesse, maybe you can jump in here too, how has this changed in the past few decades? I know that I was looking through some of your material and saw that there was a resolution passed in 1990 by the legislature about, you know, identifying this risk that these vessels posed. So this has been an issue that's been around for a long time, probably as long as vessels, so way before 1990. But it was recognized formally by the legislature at that time. How has it changed since the time of that resolution? Jesse?
Sure, I'll take the first stab at that. It has changed. It's gotten worse over the years. And I think generally speaking, the reason it's gotten worse is that the fleet age in Alaska just keeps on aging. And there's really no place for these vessels to go. Generally speaking, I think that's overall the problem.
Steve? If I can add on to that, the increase in maritime traffic, whether pleasure or commercial or sport, is significant from what it was many years ago. And with the aging fleet, as Justy rightly points out. Also, we've been very successful at trying to stop the bleeding on vessels that go aground by accident or what have you. Usually those vessels that go aground have responsible owners, they have insurance, and historically, over, say 20, 30 years ago, those boats may have been left on the coastline. That's not being allowed anymore. But the aging fleet, the lack of infrastructure, the changing economies in our rural areas all play a role in proper disposal of these vessels.
Sure. And Rachel, with Cook Inlet Keeper, did you want to get into this part of the conversation as well?
Yeah, and I just wanted to point out, as in 2014, the McDowell Group did a commission study on the Alaska maritime industrial support sector and looking at trends and opportunities. And in their assessment for the opportunities for the industrial sector as far as shipbuilding and new shipwork goes, it was touted as a benefit. But from the derelict vessel end, it's a very much a red flag. they said that many vessels in the fleet are nearing the end of their useful life, and by 2025, the Alaska fleet will include roughly 3,100 vessels that are between 28 and 59 feet that are more than 45 years old. And we also have 75 passenger vessels, tugs, and barges over 50 years old, and that includes our state ferry, Testamina, that's nearing the end of her life. So, you know, I think that it's been identified by a lot of folks that this is an issue, and whether you see it as a positive for shipbuilding or as a grave concern for what's going to happen to these boats when their commercial or useful life ends, we don't have disposal plans in place for these vessels, whether they be state or federally owned or personally, individually owned, in the coming years.
All right. So if you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are talking about the problem of abandoned and derelict vessels that are sometimes the owners can't be found and the cost can run into the millions of dollars. And the local community or the state could be on the hook for paying those costs. We have guests in the studio. Steve Russell is the DEC Spill Prevention Manager, and Justy McDonald is with the Department of Natural Resources, is a permitting manager. Rachel Lord with Cook Inlet Keepers on the phone with us. And we're going to bring Sean, who is in Juneau, on the phone right now, who has a comment. Hi, Sean.
Yes, hello. I've got a quick question along the lines of smaller vessels, really, more of the recreational type boats, and particularly in the response to how to dispose properly of older, non-seaworthy fiberglass boats, particularly pleasure boats, cabin cruisers, because there's one of these tucked into the woods at so many different houses. You drive down and you see them just growing moss, you know, all throughout Southeast, probably everywhere along the road system, everywhere with access to the water, because it's prohibitively expensive to try to take one of these to the dump. The dumps often don't want to accept them. Burning them is a horrible idea, and it's ineffective, and you can't recycle fiberglass. Is there any program in place to maybe find a way to responsibly dispose of an older or abandoned or, a non-seaworthy fiberglass pleasure boat?
Thanks, Sean, for that question. I suspect, Steve, I saw you nodding there. I suspect that fiberglass boats probably aren't an enormous concern, but Sean raises a good point as far as not being able to recycle the fiberglass. And so what do you do with these pleasure boats that get bad?
I was nodding my head because I agree with him that that you drive along the road system and you see boats everywhere in various states of repair, and either the owners lost interest or lost ability to maintain and continue to use the vessel. Fiberglass boats are a concern, not only in the pleasure craft industry, but up into the smaller commercial fishing limit seiners and what have you. A lot of those are fiberglass. There are some landfills that will take them. Our solid waste department works with most landfill operators to develop guidelines and procedures to accept certain types of material. I'm not sure of the Juneau landfill if they would take it, but certainly there's some options available depending on the location. In more rural Alaska, remote Alaska, if you will, where they may not have sanitary landfills or the equipment capabilities to relocate the vessels to the landfills, it can pose significant problems. But most of the smaller, small bayliners or something like that, usually they can be repowered and sold. But sometimes they are, you know, the old chainsaw routine and in the back of the pickup to the dump.
And I would say that the vessels, on land and people's yards, and they are a challenge for disposal. But the cost associated with a vessel in the water is so much higher if that vessel sinks. You know, if it's no longer operable and it goes down, the pollution recovery, the pollution response, and then the recovery of that vessel, it just by orders of magnitude is so high that really our focus for derelict vessels and with the Derelict Vessel Task Force is focusing on those boats that are still in the water. Mm-hmm. And in states around the country with active derelict vessel programs, we see many of the states are moving towards establishing or working to establish these voluntary vessel turn-in programs. So for smaller vessels, having some funds available to pull those vessels and dispose of them before they sink, because that is such a costly expense, and people are seeing that as a cost saving. Do we have money for that? Is that reasonable in the state of Alaska? You know, that's not really on the table right now, but we see all of our neighbors down in the lower 48 looking towards that and moving in that direction, because they see that that's where they can save significant amounts of money over dealing with a vessel after it goes down.
So I didn't mean to minimize the problem of fiberglass boats, but I was thinking about the larger vessels that are steel hull and barges and things like that.
Correct.
Especially in riverways that are huge problems. But of course, there are a lot of fiberglass hull vessels, and so I can see why that would be a big problem. And Rachel's point is well taken, that if they're in the water, it's a much bigger risk and a lot more expense than if they might be an eyesore in the back of someone's yard, but they're not a threat to the waterway. If you're just joining us, we're talking about abandoned and derelict vessels, and you can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or if you're calling in Anchorage, 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's stay on the issue of disposal for a moment. What options are there available in the state? I'm sure that it varies widely from place to place, but let's talk about the main coastline of the state. What options are there for people who want to do the right thing, the responsible thing? All right, you're pointing at each other,
no,
Justine and Steve.
It certainly is location dependent, because the size of the vessel matters. There are several coastline communities that have substantial shoreside capability to take the boat out of the water, to bring it up to an area where it can be, if it's a steel boat, it can be cut up in the metal placed for recycling, or
sure,
placed on a barge and recycled out. The city of Homer is being very successful at just providing capabilities to dispose of larger steel vessels, and the city of Seward also has significant capabilities for that. The main trick is getting the vessel into a place that it not only safe for workers and equipment, but safe for the environment as well. A lot of these older vessels may have refrigerants on them. There still may be petroleum residuals. There may be lead paints. There may be other heavy metals and things like that. So location and process is key to getting some of these larger vessels out of the environment.
Is there?
And I think that's. Oh, sorry, Lori.
I just want to ask if there's much of a market for the salvaged material, for the metals, and for the things that can be taken off of an abandoned or a derelict vessel. Is there?
It really varies on
cost
on the,
recovery.
Yeah, it really varies on the commodities market, if you will, with scrap steel prices. I believe in. It may have been like 2010, the United States Coast Guard removed a vessel from the Saldovia Harbor, approximately 160-foot vessel, and relocated it to Homer, where the local steel recycler took possession of the vessel and cut it up and made good money at it. Made enough money to make it worth his while.
Good.
And then we went to the same recycler and said, well, can we get you interested in what's going on out in Bethel? And he said, absolutely not a chance, that it would cost way too much to go to that location and cut up those vessels and make money just on the steel or the scrap alone.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depends on that market, and that market is very volatile.
Rachel, did you want to add something?
Well, just on the issue of disposal, you know, one of the things that is, I think, can be overlooked is the and I think Steve spoke to it, the process end of things, you know, the dealing with the hazardous materials that can be left on a vessel can be extremely costly. And so, you know, as far as pulling up and burning it or, you know, or sinking off to sea, you have a lot of very strict oversight on that because of the pollution concerns. I know that the Challenger that sank off of Juno in the fall was floated and hauled to a beach and disposed of, and I believe the just for dealing with the asbestos on that vessel was around $26,000.
Yikes.
And that was just doing the asbestos abatement. So, right. You know, and you know, if it, well, why don't you just take it to the landfill, and then, well, as soon as, you know, it's nice and dry and the wind starts blowing and you get this white powder flying everywhere, you don't really want that much asbestos in your landfill or, you know, in the air after you burn it or whatnot. So I think that those concerns, these vessels can seem innocuous, but there's a lot of stuff on them that can be a great concern, you know, public health concern and environmental concern to communities around the state.
So I want to go to an email now, excuse me, from, this is an email from John Murgis, who is the manager of Island Ventures in Petersburg. And he says, I'm the manager of a commercial boatyard. Boatyards and shipyards can play a key role in preventing vessels from being abandoned in public harbors, tidelands, and waterways. He says the cost of disposing a derelict vessel in a boatyard is a small fraction of the cost of disposing one that has been abandoned elsewhere. He says, but Alaska boatyards are reluctant to accept vessels of low or negative value for fear of being stuck with the costs. He claims so far there's been no collaboration with Alaska boatyards by the state or any agency, including environmental organizations, to be part of the solution. Justy, maybe this is a spot for you to jump in here now and talk about what is there anything that looks at exactly what he's talking about, working with commercial boatyards to try to address this problem before it gets bad?
Sure. So up until a few years ago, DNR didn't have the ability to seize and dispose of any of these vessels. There has been some legislation that has now gone into fruition that we are able to do those things now. However, like Steve was saying, the geographic location of these things, sometimes it's not cost effective. And also we don't have the funding yet associated with that legislation to do these types of things.
So you have the authority, but no way to really carry it out.
Right.
Yeah, and if I can add to that, John's absolutely correct. We haven't had a broad contact with the shipyards on this issue. Certainly, we've been working with the Alaska Association of Harbor Masters and Port Administrators, who are familiar with the goings-on in the local shipyards. I clearly understand the concern that a shipyard or a repair service who takes on one of these vessels of marginal quality, one of these vessels of concern, and allow it to come into their yard, it certainly can end up being the boatyard or the mechanic's property. And that's The boat could be in their yard for years or longer, and we don't have a good answer to that as yet. The law specifically allows the boatyard or mechanic to take possession of that vessel, but it may not have enough value for them to do anything with it, mm-hmm. and it ends up being could be a chronic pollution problem to the already threatened boatyards and things like that. So it certainly is part of the long-term solution we need to be looking at, not just on the water, but also in our backyards, as was spoke about earlier, but also the shipyards as well.
Mm-hmm. So. Rachel?
And can I, yeah, I think this is a great time to maybe clarify, you know, so I work for Cook Inlet Keeper here in South Central. And what I'm doing, why am I on this call? But in 2014, on the heels of a fairly elevated case here in Ketchmack Bay of the leading lady in Kukranoff sinking in Ketchmack Bay, through my role as the coordinator for the statewide Alaska Clean Harbors Program, I had been working for years with the Alaska Association of Harbor Masters and Port Administrators. And one of the very big issues that they had brought up time and again was the concern about derelict vessels in the harbors. And they had suggested for a couple years the formation of a task force, a statewide task force, to look at proactively addressing this issue. At the when those sinkings happened at the beginning of 2013, that was a great catalyst to move in that direction. We did work with Representative Seaton's office and the association and folks around the state on passing the legislation that Josie spoke to that expanded authority beyond just the Department of Transportation to deal with these issues. But in February of 2014, through Cook Inlet Keeper, I was able to facilitate the formation of this ad hoc bin and derelict vessel task force. It's been completely open to anyone. It's true, like Steve said, we haven't reached out specifically to shipyards. We have had a little bit of engagement from the response private industry in the response sector. But sitting at the table has been all of our state agencies, natural resources, environmental conservation, fish and game, Department of Transportation. We've had some involvement from some of the Alaska legislature and the office of Lisa Murkowski, Senator Murkowski's office, the Coast Guard, NOAA, the Environmental Protection Agency. They've all been sitting at the table giving us feedback and their technical expertise in the matter. And then folks out in Bethel, the Native Council, have been helping. And then we have Birch Horton Bittner and Chereau is providing pro bono legal help to us to help look at this from a statute end of things and figure out what can we do proactively moving forward to really address this and try to prevent future, you know, to try to stop the bleeding as Steve talks about, manage the vessels that we currently have and work with all of the stakeholders around the state on not leaving it in anyone's, you know, it's not just a harbor problem, it's not just a state problem, it's not just a federal problem, it's not just a private industry problem. We all have to, you know, we all deal with these vessels, and so how can we craft legislation, how can we act moving forward to deal with them together?
Justy, you said that there there is a law in place. The legislature passed. When did that get put in place? How long has that been in effect?
I'm not sure exactly how long that's been in effect because it was originally only the Department of Transportation could functionally do anything under that. But 2 years ago, that was opened up to other state agencies, including DNR.
So it's been in place for at least 2 years.
But yes, for DNR.
Is there like absolutely no funding associated with it or just not enough funding?
Well, we get funding every year, and but there's nothing specifically that's allocated toward abandoned and derelict vessels.
So the state statute 3030, which is the derelict vessel statute, was drafted in the mid-70s, and it hadn't been changed at all until 2013. And in the 70s, the state owned all of our harbors, which is why the Department of Transportation had all the authority to deal with derelict vessels. That's no longer the case. And so in 2013, House Bill 131 opened up that authority to all state agencies and municipalities, so that if they need to take action under that law, they don't need to get an authorization from DOT to move forward. That's essentially all that did, which is great. It removes one step of that paperwork, but it's still a far cry from where we need to be as far as being able for our state agencies and our municipalities to be able to work effectively.
Steve, did you want to jump in there?
The short answer is no, there's no funding. DNR, DEC, EPA, Coast Guard have budgets, their normal operating budgets. But if it's not a significant and imminent pollution threat, we are not able to tap into the National Pollution Fund or the State Response Fund. That option is not available to us. So then we're relying, as Justy says, on our operating budgets and what have you. And the last time that we did such a thing that the state was involved in was a leading lady in Kuprinov, and that event cost over $300,000 to raise and relocate the vessels to Homer. And that was only about 8 miles. So
That gives us some scope of how expensive this problem is. We are talking about derelict and abandoned vessels and the problem that they can present to coastlines, riverways, communities, and the fact that there's not a lot of money to deal with them. We're going to continue our conversation as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the problem of derelict and abandoned vessels in Alaska. It's not just a problem here in the state. It's a problem nationally and actually across the globe. There are vessels, some of them are military vessels going back to World War II and before, that were sunk in oceans around the world during battles, and they're just laying on the bottom. So we are discussing that today with our guest, Steve Russell, who is with the Department of Environmental Conservation. He's a spill prevention and response manager. Jessity McDonald is with the Department of Natural Resources. She is a permitting manager. And we just, in the first half of the show, we also had Rachel Lord, who is with Cook Inlet Keeper, on the phone with us. Rachel, thanks so much for being on. Now we're turning to another guest, Pete Williams, who is the harbor master in Bethel. Hi, Pete.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us for a few minutes to talk about some of what you've dealt with out there. Before we get into some of what you've had to deal with in Bethel, Pete, I wanted to get back to the bar napkin question that I posed earlier at the beginning of the show about somebody goes into a bar, they have a couple of drinks, they decide to buy a boat and scribble it out, the details on a napkin, and voila, suddenly they're a vessel owner. Then a year later, the vessel is in disrepair, the new owner with his bar napkin title can't do anything about it. First of all, can someone go get a title without any kind of legal documentation other than just this bar napkin? How tough is it to get a title? When we were talking earlier, it sounded like there was more regulations for the trailer that the boat's going to be on than the vessel itself.
Correct.
How does that work?
The state of Alaska doesn't really require a title for a vessel. It's not taxed in the manner of a vehicle or what have you. In the mid-80s, I bought a 38-foot old wood boat that I bought from a guy I worked with. And it was, okay, here's $1,500. The boat belongs to you. There was no receipt. There was no paperwork. I went to DMV and got my my boat sticker, the little sticker that you put on there, and was no problem whatsoever.
So you just said, I own this boat. Did you have a picture of it, or how?
No,
you...
no, I just walked in, filled out the form, and it had an old number on there, and they said, cool, $20, you're good to go. And then I went to the Coast Guard to look to see what I needed to do with this boat, and they had no record of the boat whatsoever. And I said, well, what do I do? And they said, carry on, you know. And
how do you get insurance then?
Well, at that time in the mid-80s, I didn't have insurance, but that really played no role in it, because you could, as long as you had possession and you could demonstrate some sort of ownership, the insurance companies are willing to take your money and take the risk. But you're not required to have insurance on boats in the state. Responsible operators and owners do. And in most cases, the policies are adequate. But the vessels of concerns are the vessel or the derelict vessels around. One of the first things that lapse is going to be the insurance.
Hmm.
And then boat maintenance and what have you.
Sure.
You're not going to have insurance on a boat that is in disrepair and you're not utilizing. So.
Mm-hmm. Pete Williams, Harbor Master in Bethel, is on the phone with us. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or in Anchorage, 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Pete, tell us about what you're dealing with in the Bethel area. You've got vessels in Steamboat Slough, Nepakiak, Bethel Harbor, Queethluck. Sounds like you're dealing with a lot out there.
Yeah, this is Pete Williams with the City of Bethel. So most of those boats aren't within the jurisdiction of the City of Bethel's city's limits, and I'm being port director and working for the City of Bethel. There hasn't been a lot that we could do directly to dispose of some of these boats. When I first came here in 2005, we had seven or eight derelict vessels that were sitting on the city dock, and we went to an attorney and went through the process of what the task force is going through now to try to get into state law to dispose of those. So ours have, we've kind of gotten rid of most of it. We still got a few on city property up in the boat harbor. But basically, it's been a real big challenge. It's been a big expense with attorneys to make sure that we're following a process because we need to seize these boats, and then after we seize them, we had to do something with them. Either the owner, if we were lucky to find the owner, hauled them off, or in some cases, we ended up paying the expense of hauling them to the dump. So, and because of that, I've been kind of following this issue ever since.
So, Pete, the vessel that's in Steamboat Slough, that had some news coverage. Tell us about that, what's going on there, and why that's such a hazard.
Well, I think the government agencies have pretty much taken that over as far as what's being done about it. But why it's such a hazard is that you have a relatively narrow channel, maybe 75 feet wide, that traditionally fish camps and whatnot have been to the channel itself. The uplands have been used for fish camps for many, many years, and this one particular vessel slunk right in the middle of that narrow channel. And during the wintertime, of course, it freezes over and it's used by snow machines. So during the summer, we've had boats that, these are skiffs, you know, and they're 25, 30-foot skiffs. And skiffs have kind of evolved over the years, and now you're putting $40,000, $50,000 into a skiff. Motors are very expensive, $10,000, $15,000. And when you hit one of these, hit this, you run over something, an obstruction like this, it has it can cause people in the boat to get hurt and it can cause damage to the boat, which is very expensive. So, of course, the owner of the boat is interested in finding out whose vessel it is and feels probably rightfully so that they should pay for the damage. The bigger issue on that is what happened in the wintertime where a snow machine ran into it and actually had three fingers smashed. A person had three fingers smashed, and ended up hurt enough where he crawled off into the bushes, and he was rescued finally. But so these are the kind of it really creates a hazard that, and then with nobody pursuing the issue, it could be there for years and years and years. In fact, it has been at least 4 or 5 years since this vessel sunk, and we have yet to be able to get it removed.
All right. Thanks for giving us kind of the scope of that. That was Pete Williams, who is the harbor master in Bethel. Justy, what is the state able to do or considering doing, if anything, with this vessel that's creating this hazard in the waterway?
So there's about 35 vessels out there in the Steamboat Bethel area that have been considered abandoned, and or derelict. We've worked closely, DNR has worked closely with DEC and the U.S. Coast Guard and the Army Corps of Engineers to figure out what the best solution is. The task force has also taken this on to see what they can do. Currently, under our regulation, a vessel that's anchored more than 14 days or less than 14 days is generally allowed. Anything more than that requires an authorization. These vessels have clearly been anchored out there for much, much longer. We have posted all these vessels in trespass and worked with the owners of each vessel to try to get them into compliance and come up with removal plans to get them out of there. We've had a couple operators that have worked very well with us, are coming into compliance, getting their permits, talking to us about how they're going to remove them.
And when you say getting their permits to actually do the removal of the vessel?
Yes, okay. Removal of the vessel, or to anchor them there, because some of the there are some vessels up there that are not abandoned and aren't derelict, and they do want to store them there. So we have a regulation that allows them to store their vessel there for 6 months or a year at a certain fee.
How much teeth does state law have for the vessels that are creating a hazard? And you said you're working with owners. If they say, sorry, I don't have any money, I can't do anything about this, what happens then? What can the state do?
Right. So that's very common, that the owners will actually not have the money to do anything with these. And we follow our trespass laws and our violation laws. However, DNR currently lacks the ability of enforcement authority. So we aren't able to fine an individual for any sort of action that's happening out there. Currently, for Steamboat Slough, we have turned over our case to our Department of Law, and they are actively pursuing the legal case against a few operators.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Bob is in Bethel and has a comment about derelict vessels. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, hi. Interesting. Pete was just on. I worked for DEC in Bethel for 20 years, and my experience was that the state took a far different view of Western Alaska and the issues out there than they would have in Central Alaska, Kenai River, Cook Inlet, those sorts of things. Incidentally, that vessel, actually it's a barge that sunk in Steamboat Slough 4 or 5 years ago. And we knew who the owner was and also the operator, different parties, but both of them were viable companies. It wasn't abandoned by, some operator that was out of business, and yet nothing was done about it. And I don't know at this point with the silt and everything whether it's even possible to remove that vessel, but it's plumb in the middle of a bend in the channel. It's obviously a navigation hazard, and we just couldn't get anyone interested in doing anything about it, including the Coast Guard. But I have another comment I want to make, and Steve is familiar with this. There's another contractor. Well, actually, this contractor was involved in that sunken barge, but he brought an old derelict tugboat up Steamboat Slough and tied it off and left it there. And one summer, I got a complaint that it was leaking oil, and I went up, investigated, and found that it was. put some boom, sorghum boom around it. I was unable to get authorization to really do anything beyond that for the entire summer. I wrote the contractor a letter. This is a person or a company that had resources to act on this, but I was unable to do anything. And Steve may want to comment on that because he was my supervisor.
Was it eventually resolved?
Yes, there was. The case Bob is talking.
Can I just finish my comments,
sure.
Please?
Sure.
So, I wrote this contractor letter and probably a couple letters. He ignored it, which I expected. The upshot of it, this old tug puked oil all summer long, and we really did nothing about it. And if that had been in, around Anchorage or Homer or someplace like that, it wouldn't have gotten immediate attention by the state. But for some reason, we couldn't, offend this contractor, in my view. And I think that there's just been, in West Alaska, there's been this sort of attitude that, it's out of sight, out of mind for most of the enforcement people. And the same contract had a barge up in Queefuck, and you kind of mentioned that. And that barge is still there, as far as I know. He never did get it out of there. It didn't get out several pieces of equipment that were, initially had been leaking oil into the river at Queefuck.
Okay, Bob, let's let the state folks respond. Thanks so much for telling us about those vessels and your thoughts on that Western Alaska gets treated differently than Anchorage or other parts of the state. I imagine that a lot of the reason that it's more difficult in that area is simply the remote nature of where these vessels are and the expense associated with it. But Steve and or Jesdy, do you want to jump in there?
Absolutely. The locations have the logistics to certain locations can play a significant role. Also, the degree of contamination is that in order to access the state pollution fund for takeover of incidents, you have to declare significant and imminent threat to the environment and public health. And intermittent sheen from time to time may not qualify for that. We did get resolution to the tugboat, the St. Michael there. The owner, we did require the owner to remove all potential sources of pollution. So we required him to take all motors, hydraulic lines, fuel lines, all of that off. And eventually he stripped the vessel down to the bare hull. So he did remove the pollution there. It is very difficult when you...
But it sounds like it took months before
it,
that
it
happened.
It took months, correct. It took a long time.
It's part of the reason because, as Jesdy was saying, there's laws in place, but there's not a lot of money to back it up or even... It sounds like there's not a lot of teeth in the law to really go after people and say, hey, you got 10 days to get this vessel stripped and the fluids out of it. How do you pressure people into making this happen?
So it's a little bit different for DEC and DNR. Just to clarify a few things, DEC, once something happens, there's a shipwreck or discovery of this abandoned or derelict vessel that has pollution threats on board, they will take it on. We will be part of their unified command. They will do everything they can to remove those pollution threats. And then once they're done, their jurisdiction really ends. And then it becomes DNR's jurisdiction. And this is where DNR and the general public is left with these vessels that are just littering the shorelines of Alaska. So there's a little bit different regulatory authorities that we both operate under, but we do work closely together to try to mend those as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But there is some teeth. There's not a whole lot of teeth, but it takes time and it takes money.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the problem of derelict and abandoned vessels as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University provides working professionals an educational pathway to career advancement. Through APU's hybrid course format of online and campus-based courses, students can focus on healthcare, finance, technology, and strategic leadership options. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing derelict and abandoned vessels. Steve Russell is with DEC, and you wanted to respond to that last bit of...
Well, I'd just like to clarify the position a little bit in that what we're talking about here in a lot of cases is the state or federal government confiscating someone's personal property. And certainly a lot of these events take a very long time to address, because we want to give the owners give them every opportunity before the state or federal government actually confiscates your property. And,
sure.
And as soon as that happens, all kinds of legal worms jump up outside of the significant expense there. The state does not want to be in the business of confiscating personal property. So
that makes
sense. We take that very, very seriously.
But if a vessel's leaking, if it's like an imminent threat to waterways, and certainly the Coast Guard has authority to, if they suspect a boat of drug running or something, they can board it right now if they want to.
Well, if it's a pollution threat, especially if it's a significant and imminent pollution threat, or we deem the on-scene coordinators deem it to be a threat of that nature, there are numerous avenues that we can take to address the pollution threat. We always want to stop short of actually taking possession of the vessel, because then the state owns it, and we really shouldn't be in that business. The responsible party should be required, either through encouragement
or a legal hammer if you need.
A legal hammer if we need it to make them clean up their mess or pay for the cleanup. But actually taking possession of the vessel is something that both the state and the Coast Guard are very, very reluctant to do.
I could see why, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which would be the great expense if it's a vessel that is a hazard that has to be salvaged and cleaned up.
And many of us don't feel that should be a quick process or necessarily easy process. We want
to
be very,
property.
Very cautious. And it does take time for the event when those things happen. So.
We had an email question from Carol in Seward, who says, recently a fishing vessel grounded on an island in Resurrection Bay. The fuel and other fluids were removed. When the boat was being towed to Seward, it mysteriously and conveniently sank. She says, is disposal in the ocean allowed? What are the environmental consequences? So can somebody say, oops, my derelict vessel sank out in the ocean?
It happens. A lot of these vessels are very unstable. When you remove the weight of the fluids or the weight of the hazmat, it certainly has happened numerous times before. I think I know the boat that Carol is talking about, and did not know it actually capsized and sank in Resurrection Bay, but it is a common occurrence. The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA folks, have authority over offshore dumping, if you will, or scuttling of vessels. It is something that the state and the Coast Guard does not encourage, and there is a potentially lengthy process that is in place that owners can do this, but it usually ends up being incredibly expensive.
Yep, I would agree with that. I would agree with Steve on that, and I do think I know the boat that Carol is talking about as well. Mm-hmm. And we're currently pursuing more information on that vessel that has sunk.
So could this be a situation where if it's determined, and how would you determine if it was somebody did this purposefully without the proper steps in place? What happens? Are they fined? What could the consequences be?
They are essentially trespassed, which could then be prosecuted either civilly or criminally.
Mm-hmm. And if I can add, this was not, if this, you cannot dump vessels in Kachemak or in Resurrection Bay. That just, no, that's not
so
allowed.
Even if you did get permission, it would have to be somewhere else. It could not be in those waters.
It would not be in those waters. Mm-hmm. I believe 60 miles offshore is something that's the minimum. Mm. The middle of Resurrection Bay is not acceptable.
60 miles offshore. Another email comment from Janet, who says, here's an idea for gaining some funds to take care of vessels through the original sale of the vessel, as she's likening it to a deposit on soda bottles or cans, mm-hmm. like they have in Oregon. Mm-hmm. She says, you know, why not charge a fee when you're transferring the vessel and put that money somewhere, maybe like a mini super fund for cleaning up vessels?
So if Rachel's on the line, she could speak to this, but our task force, you know, does often look into these ideas, and but to pass something like this would require legislation.
Correct.
Okay.
A permanent fund for abandoned derelict vessels is a great idea, but yes, we have to get a new tax or a new user fee through the legislature, and in these political times, that's going to be incredibly difficult to do.
It certainly sounds like it would be. Thank you so much for your time. We're already, an hour has gone by, and we barely touched the surface of this issue for the state and state waters. Thanks so much to my guest, Steve Russell, with DEC, Department of Environmental Conservation. He's a spill prevention manager. And Justy McDonald, who is with the Department of Natural Resources. She's a permitting manager. Thanks also to Rachel Lord, who was on the line with us from Cook Inlet Keeper, and Pete Williams, who is the Bethel Harbor Master. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening today to Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The outside view of the Arctic is a place of mythic proportions, fantastical, romantic, and mysterious. Contemporary artists break open the mythical idea of the Arctic in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, A View from Up Here, The Arctic at the Center of the World. Take a revealing look at the Arctic as a place of adaptation, complex landscapes, and diverse people. See The View from Up Here at the Anchorage Museum, open daily 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.